December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
It is a crisis of confidence.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. It's President's Day month. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Moog, and welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. You're probably familiar with the voices we just heard. Those of our post-World War II presidents, at least most of them. Their words are etched into our national consciousness and kept alive by video and parodies and men named Dean Karyanis.
We heard nine presidents there in that montage, number right. 32 through 40. That's FDR through Ronald Reagan. But what about their predecessors, the ones before moving images, the ones before the clips that we see all the time? We don't really ever hear their voices. And so we decided to dig back and find some of their predecessors, the ones who we have their voices. We don't have video of them speaking necessarily, but we have their voices. Did you ever wonder what Benjamin Harrison sounded like, for example, or Theodore Roosevelt or Herbert Hoover?
Or Woodrow Wilson?
Yeah, I know what he sounds like. Sounds like that angry guy on the bus just screaming because he claims he got the wrong change. But anyway, I guess we'll have to...
Dude. You're not going to escape this whole Wilson thing until you face it. It's like that recurring nightmare I had as a kid. There's this drugstore by our house in East Flatbush, and it had a garage there, and it was on a deep ramp slope, and I used to dream that the Penguin, Burgess Meredith, was at the bottom of it. Waiting to kill
me. Was he?
So night after night, well, I'm still here, so maybe he just wasn't that good. But until I really faced it, Dean, it just wouldn't go away. Once I faced it, it went away. Face Wilson. Face him. He'll go away.
There's a chance Batman saved you, though. That's why I asked.
Yeah, I guess, maybe. But hey, anyway, today we're taking you back to the very earliest days of recorded presidential voices. It's funny, it must have been so easy to be Rich Little back then. You know, here's my Polk impression. No president who performs his duties faithfully and conscientiously can have any leisure. That sounds nothing like Polk. Oh yeah? Prove it! All right, okay, here we go. Benjamin Harrison. He was elected in 1888 over the incumbent Grover Cleveland, winning the Electoral College, but not the popular vote.
Right. If people know much about Harrison at all, it's that he was so nondescript, or maybe that he was the grandson of William Henry Harrison.
Yeah, he's on the dollar bill.
Yeah, he's not remembered much either since he only served 30 days.
Right.
He was always described as very lame, depressing. They said his handshake felt like a wilted petunia.
That's nice. And
this is back in the day. You could just kind of go to the White House and meet the president.
Right.
They sometimes referred to him as the human iceberg.
And as you might expect from a recording made 125 years ago on an Edison wax cylinder, these early recordings, they're a little hard to hear. So here's what you'll hear President Harrison say. Quote, "As President of the United States, I was present at the first Pan-American Congress in Washington, D.C. I believe that with God's help, our two countries shall continue to live side by side in peace and prosperity. Benjamin Harrison." End quote.
As President of the United States, I was present at the first Pan-American Congress in Washington, D.C. I believe that with God's help, our two countries shall continue to live side by side in peace and prosperity. Benjamin Harrison.
The wax cylinders had a very narrow frequency band, so the sound is heavily compressed, and that brings out that kind of wavering mid-range frequency that you heard there in President Harrison.
Right.
And it's kind of like you're speaking into a coffee can if you did that when you were a kid, right?
Exactly. But despite the muffling, you can hear there is a certain level of animation in his voice. I mean, I wonder what it would have been like to listen to the guy in person. So Harrison was preceded and succeeded by the same man, our 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland, Uncle Jumbo, as he was affectionately called. He was also the first Democrat elected since the Civil War, but there's no audio of Cleveland. So, Dean, what'd you find on this one?
There's a mislabeled clip out there that's labeled as Grover Cleveland. It's on the web in a lot of places. It's on YouTube. But as I was listening to it, and because I have William McKinley on the brain, I thought the word sounded familiar, and it's William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech. Oh. Bryan was the Democratic nominee in 1896 when they moved away from Grover Cleveland, and Cleveland actually ended up supporting McKinley across party lines because of the gold standard issue.
All right.
He was only 36, youngest major party candidate for president in history, and remains so to the current day, was William Jennings Bryan.
Bryan, who fell twice to McKinley, right, and then Taft. Let's hear a bit of this mislabeled Bryan. Here we go.
All ancestors, when what created us, had the courage to declare their political independence to every other nation upon earth. Now we, their descendants, when we have ruled the seven nations, declare that we are less independent than our forefathers. No, my friends, it will never be the judgment of this people.
Again, a little hard to hear. More a sense of the tone and animation than so much the content of what he's saying. All right, so we're going to skip Cleveland and move on to your main man, William McKinley.
Yay.
The major, the last Civil War veteran to serve in the White House, and the first reelected since Grant. And here he is, 1896, running for president in the midst of a very deep depression for the United States. Here we go.
I, fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War. Then it was a struggle to preserve the government of the United States. Now it is a struggle to preserve the financial honor of the government. Our creed embraces an honest dollar, an untarnished national credit, adequate revenues for the uses of the government, protection to labor and industry, preservation of the home market, and reciprocity, which will extend our foreign market. Upon this platform we stand and submit its declaration to the sober and considerate judgment of the American people.
You know, in Chicago, the dead vote. Can those who weren't born yet go back and vote for McKinley?
Yes.
Because I am moved. I'm full on for the gold standard now.
Of course you are.
And you notice there the audio quality and what the cylinders picked up. Because
sure.
McKinley had that deep voice at the time, they likened it to a bell being rung. It really picked him up much better than we heard there with Harrison or with Bryan. And it just so happened that his voice, the cylinder loved it, I guess, to sort of twist a modern metaphor.
Absolutely. And I imagine, you know, the intervening years, too. I mean, the improvements in the quality of the equipment were just steadily going up and up and up as well.
Also, you heard some of the crowd noise there. The other one, obviously, Benjamin Harrison. I mean, it wasn't even a microphone back then. He would have been speaking into a tube. And
right. So
this one kind of picks up. There's sort of that. I always think they sound like a ghostly quality, the crowd there, when they start cheering.
Oh, yeah, that was kind of chilling. Yeah.
It's
like the Haunted Mansion at Disney. You know?
Yeah.
Welcome, 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 foolish mortals.
Very ghost-like.
Okay, next we have the Rough Rider, Theodore Roosevelt. And if you look at the man, you'd think that he's got to have sort of voice so deep that it would shatter redwoods, which is not the case, though. But this is a speech he gave in Emporia, Kansas, on September 22nd, 1912. It was recorded by the Victor Talking Machine Company. It's 4 years after he left the White House, 7 years before his death, and he's running on the Bull Moose ticket against both his hand-picked Republican successor, William Howard Taft, and the Democratic nominee, what's his name, Dean?
Thomas Wilson, actually. Thomas Woodrow Wilson. He's lying even about that.
Okay. Here we go, TR.
The big bosses of the political field, the beneficiaries of privilege in the field of industry, the men who represent that sinister alliance between crooked politics and crooked business, which has done more than anything else for the corruption of American life, are united as one man against the genuine rule of the people themselves. The privileged classes, the representatives of special privilege, of special interests, can always make terms with a boss or bosses. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Republican Party. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Democratic Party. But they can't make terms with the people. They can't make terms with the men who honestly and genuinely represent the popular will.
You know, you were saying, Owen, that TR must have had a voice that was just booming. And it occurs to me that Patton thought the same thing. They said he really would have thought that George C. Scott had the voice he would have liked, because he also had kind of that high, reedy voice. And this is always one of the most surprising ones, because you just have a vision of somebody's voice in your head. Sort of like when you talk to somebody, right? Only on the phone, you picture that they're going to look a certain way.
Kind of interesting, too, because you think about, you know, what this notion of presidential timbre, and like a lot of these guys would have run into problems in the media age. You know, it's like, could you imagine, you know, having to listen to TR's voice as much as we do a current president? It just might not have played, you know?
Yeah, I thought that about Wilson. I thought, you know, then Princeton is this little sort of backwater college. Rutgers beats them in the first football game, of course. We haven't won much since, so we have to talk about that a lot.
That's right.
Anyway, and I said, you know, so imagine sitting there with that guy droning there at the front of the class. And that actually did hurt him a little bit when he ran and when he was trying to get the League of Nations going and when he went to Europe after the war, because really you do need to move people with your voice. I mean, we see it now because of television, but
sure,
there were a lot of these guys, like with Harrison. I mean, you know, you don't want to meet a guy and have a limp handshake and be kind of,
right,
even though they didn't have TV, people would certainly notice it in person.
Right. Absolutely.
That's kind of a short TR, so let's have another. This is from the summer of 1912, in the heat of Roosevelt's campaign to win back the White House. This is before he takes a bullet in the chest, as we discussed in the Slocum episode. The Edison Company recorded this on a cylinder again in Roosevelt's hometown of Oyster Bay, Long Island.
The great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated briefly. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not. I believe in the right of the people to rule. I believe that the majority of the plain people of the United States will, day in and day out, make fewer mistakes in governing themselves than any smaller class or body of men, no matter what their training, will make in trying to govern them. I believe, again, that the American people are, as a whole, capable of self-control and of learning by their mistakes. Our opponents pay lip loyalty to this doctrine, but they show their real belief by the way in which they champion every device to make the nominal rule of the people a sham. I am not leading this fight as a matter of aesthetic pleasure. I am leading because somebody must lead, or else the fight would not be made at all.
Next up is William Howard Taft, the only president to serve in the White House and on the Supreme Court as Chief Justice. It's kind of wild. The Victor Talking Machine Company recorded this in Beverly, Massachusetts on October 1st, 1912, about a month before he would not only lose his office, but come in third to who, Dean?
Woodrow Wilson.
And Theodore Roosevelt. It's on the subject of war and peace. Let's give a listen.
I am willing to admit that war has accomplished much in the progress of the world. I'm willing to admit that there are certain crises in the forward march of Christian civilization that perhaps could not have been met in any other way than by the sword. I'm willing to admit that war develops certain heroic traits in men and furnishes a test for the evidence of the highest character. Perhaps, too, it trains and disciplines people. But the other side of the picture justifies the prayer of every man, of every civilized man, that war should be abolished, and that the suffering, cruelty, corruption, and demoralization that follow in its train should be, as far as we can bring it about, lifted as a burden from the human race. It is our duty to take every legitimate and proper step we can to persuade the nations of the world to settle their controversies in some other way. They are looking to us as a country independent of entangling alliances, separated from all possible attacks by two wide oceans, rich, powerful, and in a situation where nobody can accuse us of being afraid of any nation or of taking this step because we are afraid of war if war were a necessity. It is the common people of the world that are interested in this business. They know when we have war, it is they that have to bear the burden. It's their sisters and mothers and daughters that have to wait, trembling, to hear the news from the battlefield to learn whether their dear ones have bitten the dust. It's the great mass of the plain people that Lincoln loved so well that have to stand the brunt of war. They do not have the glory of coming home with the gold lace and the feathers and all that falls to the leader. They are not elected presidents because they happen to be successful. They know the demoralization that follows in the wake of war. We should lead the way, and all doubt as to our constitutional authority should be resolved in favor of our stepping forward as a nation with the power, the wealth, the fortune, and the opportunity that God has given us to help along the movement of Christian progress toward permanent peace.
When you listen to Taft, you could see him on the bench. I mean, he has a very judicial temperament. He's making his case there against war and to people who might be a little quick to go to war. But it reminds me of the fact that that was really his destiny and his dream was to be on the Supreme Court. And when they had dinner at the White House one night in 1908, Roosevelt did this bit where he pretended to be a swami. He said, "I am the seventh son of a seventh daughter, and I have clairvoyant powers. I see a man weighing 350 pounds. There is something hanging over his head. I cannot make out what it is. At one point, it looks like the presidency. Then again, it looks like the chief justiceship." Taft said, "Make it the chief justiceship." This was his dream. But his wife, Nellie Taft, said, "Make it the presidency." Well, any man who's been married knows which one Taft ended up doing. And so he ran, but he was really a reluctant president.
That's
the thing people, of course, know most about him is how much weight he gained. Maybe they don't know he gained it, but he gained all that in the White House just out of the stress, eating all the time. But he really dropped it, too, when he came out of the White House. And I sent you the map one time, or the graph, rather, about how much weight he lost. He really did slim down. He wouldn't have been considered as tremendous as he looks because we're, again, so visually focused on just seeing him when he was president. I mean, he was always a large guy. He made a lot of jokes about his weight. They offered him a distinguished chair at some college or other. I forget which one. And he said, well, maybe a sofa would be more appropriate. You know, he loved to tell jokes about his own weight. And he was a pretty jovial guy. And it's too bad the only thing that we remember are those pictures we see of him being a giant president.
I like big butts and I cannot lie.
All right, now we come to Thomas Woodrow Wilson accepting the Democratic nomination for president on August 21st, 1912. T.R. said of Wilson, quote, "When I was president, it was said of me that I spoke softly and carried a big stick. It can be said of Wilson that he speaks bombastically and wields a dish rag." End quote. All right, let's give a listen.
There never was a time when impatience and suspicion were more keenly aroused by private power self-employed, when jealousy of everything concealed or touched with any purpose not linked with the general good or inconsistent with it, more sharply or immediately displayed itself. Nor was the country ever more susceptible to unselfish appeals or to the high arguments of sincere justice. These are the unmistakable symptoms of an awakening.
Mushmouth and pumpkin puss.
He sounds like the doctor in the Jekyll and Hyde episode of Bugs Bunny. I mean, he sounds like Mel Blanc.
Come, little bunny rabbit. Come on. Come. Rabbits are such timid creatures.
I can't imagine T.R. just literally pulling his hair out that this guy's running the country in the middle of a big war. T.R. was able to speak up. I mean, one of the reasons that I just do not like the guy is he gets a really great spot in the history books when you win a world war. Of course, he wanted a victory without or an end of the war without victors, but he crushed civil liberties. We've discussed this so many times. I mean, deported Emma Goldman, just throws all these people out. I mean, if you think if anyone was going to start cracking down on things, it would have been TR when he had every reason to do after they shot McKinley. But Wilson, I mean, some crazy stuff if you look into it, what he was doing.
It's going to be interesting. I mean, you know, we sort of make the joke about how much you despise him, but it'll be interesting when we do get around to the full-length Wilson show.
Well, I try not to, you know, get too angry or...
What? When was is this a future? Is this like a future resolution?
Just, you know, it's a dish rag. You heard TR. Come on, I mean, the guy sounds like toast. Okay, anyway,
all right,
white toast. So anyway, in 1920, Americans turned to Ohio Senator Warren G. Harding. By then, Wilson had been crippled by a series of strokes, and I legitimately feel bad for him. That's a terrible thing to go through. Really, he couldn't perform his duty as president anymore, but he was still planning to run for a third term. TR was the likely choice for the Republicans against him, having mended their fences over the rough election of 1912.
Right.
But as you said before, he died. He died in his sleep on January 19th of 1919 of a coronary embolism. Death had to take him sleeping, Vice President Thomas R. Marshall remarked. or there would have been a fight.
Indeed, there would have been. So we got Harding, who was nominated literally because they said he looked like a president, which is, hey, you know, I guess there are worse reasons. No, there's no worse reason. Anyway, he won on a landslide over fellow Ohioan James M. Cox and his running mate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, chosen to capitalize on the nostalgia after the death of T.R., which is an interesting little nugget.
Yeah, that's another thing we'd like to talk about, how he sort of pushed Theodore Roosevelt Jr. aside to be governor of New York, and him and his first cousin, T.R.'s niece, Eleanor, they really savaged him over some of these scandals because, you know, they wanted... Yeah, then that all came to light here after Harding's death, and they really used it against him, and he hadn't been involved in it and helped expose it in some ways.
Right.
For Harding, winning was easy, but governing was hard, which is how he ended up with those kinds of scandals. His father actually told him once, "Warren, it's a good thing you're a man, because if you were a woman, you'd always be in a family way. You just can't say no to anybody."
Oh, man.
And, yeah. It's a nice,
that is rough.
Yeah, it's a nice birds and the bees story to have with your dad, especially, you know, back at the turn of the century. You know, he's just probably blushing a little. But
you see that little piece of ankle? Let's talk about that.
Well, Harding was no innocent. Once at a friend's farm, someone heard squealing out behind the house. They investigated and found a bunch of older men squirting teenage girls with the water hose. Naked teenage girls.
Oh,
Harding,
man,
was laughing and enjoying the show the most, they said. Of course, Harding's mistress, Nan Britton, also wrote The President's Daughter in 1928 after he was dead, naming him as the father of her daughter. Politicians were having a lot of sex in the roaring 20s, at least our buddy Warren G. Harding was. Not like today where it's texting or somebody sends a picture of some body part or something,
right,
or an email or something like that. I mean, Warren Harding's sex scandals had actual sex. I mean, this was the old days. They didn't have phones, so what are they going to do? They
exactly. Do it. Smoke signals didn't work out too well.
Yeah.
A lot of people died of smoke inhalation and all that.
What's that cloud look like? Don't look, little Johnny.
Don't look. Sometimes a cloud is just a cloud.
So here he is, a senator, Warren G. Harding, truly one of our forgotten presidents, speaking on the eve of the Great War.
My countrymen, the surpassing war of all times has involved us and found us utterly unprepared in either a mental or military sense. The Republic must awaken. The people must understand. Our safety lies in full realization. The fate of the nation and the safety of the world will be decided on the western battlefront of Europe. Primarily, the American Republic has entered the war in defense of its national rights. If we did not defend, we could not hope to endure. Other big issues are involved, but the maintained rights and defended honor of a righteous nation include them all. Cherishing the national rights the fathers fought to establish, and loving freedom and civilization, we should have violated every tradition and sacrificed every inheritance if we had longer held aloof from the armed conflict which is to make the world safe for civilization. More, we are committed to sacrifice and battle in order to make America safe for Americans and establish their security on every lawful mission on the high seas or under the shining sun.
He was talking there about Wilson, who'd won re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." But he'd been unable to keep that promise as the Kaiser became more and more aggressive, such as sinking the HMS Lusitania in 1915, killing 128 Americans, and there were British propaganda stories, often invented out of whole cloth, about atrocities, and those got in the American newspapers and really outraged people.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny you mentioned Lusitania. I do want to revisit that at some point. I had a relative who survived the sinking and swam to Ireland, where he eventually died, but an amazing story of terror and adventure. But maybe we'll get to that someday.
Wow.
Harding ran on the slogan, "A return to normalcy." And after the ravages of the First World War and the big Spanish flu outbreak of 1918 that followed, and ultimately killed more people than the horrors of those trenches, Harding himself died less than 2.5 years into his term. It was the fourth shortest presidency.
Yeah, and one of the reasons we don't know a lot about him or even the scandals that happened is his wife, known as the Duchess, burned all of his papers. She sat there with his body and said, "They can't hurt you anymore. I burned everything." So we don't really know. We don't really know how he died is a little mysterious.
And in her grief, she didn't even have the forethought to think that maybe his words down the road would burnish his reputation.
Yeah, it kind of bugs me when they want to burn their stuff. But recently, Pope John Paul II had asked somebody to burn his papers, and the guy said he didn't have the courage to do it, and so he's going to publish it in a book instead.
There's a difference between not having the courage to do something
and
then publishing a book on it instead.
Like Robert Mitchum, he wanted his ashes to be sprinkled over the sea, but his family just couldn't do it, so they sprinkled them over Seagram's. I said, if it's the person's last wish, all those early presidents, Washington, it's terrible that they burned their papers. I hate it. But, if that's their final wish, you've got to respect it.
It's like that episode of Sopranos when Livia dies and Janice is sort of just kind of hammering Tony to have a service for Ma, and Tony finally capitulates and they throw this big funeral for their mother, whose stated wish was to not have one. And Carmela, half in the bag is like, and everyone is sort of starting to bitch about what a nightmare she was. And she's like, "Yeah, listen, you guys are all here in this position. She didn't want this.
And if you want my advice, don't expect happiness. You won't get it. People let you down. And I'm not naming any names. But in the end, you die in your own arms."
She knew how hated she was. She wanted to do all this to go away. Anyway, I'm sorry. We have to include these things sometimes because that's how my mind works.
Yep, sure. Hey, I'm right there with you. So the presidency devolved to the vice president, Calvin Coolidge, born on the 4th of July, as was Al Gore, incidentally. He learned of Harding's death in the middle of the night, Calvin Coolidge, while at his childhood home in Vermont. Can you imagine? Man. You're sitting there in your bed with your fire faucet poster on the wall or whatever you had then, and all of a sudden your dad knocks on the door. "Hey, you're president." He's like, "Don't! What's that magazine you have there, Cal?" Nothing.
Just leave me alone.
And he then had the distinction of his father being the one who swore him into office because his father was a notary public and that made it legal.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. They're sort of this hardy New England stock. They're not very emotive, but...
My dad never swore me in. He just used to swear at me, so...
Yeah. Yeah, Cool just went upstairs and went to bed after that, I believe. It's like, that's just a different world,
The election of 1920, though, is sometimes called the kangaroo election because the bottoms of the ticket, vice presidential candidates Coolidge and FDR, turned out to be actually so much stronger than the tops of the tickets, Harding and Cox. And here's Coolidge speaking as president in 1926. And keep an ear out for his distinctive New England accent here.
"It is preeminently the province of government to protect the weak. The average citizen does not lead the life of independence that was his in former days, under a less complex order of society. When a family tilled the soil and produced its own support, it was independent. It may be infinitely better off now, but it is evident it needs a protection which before was not required. Let Massachusetts continue to regard with the gravest solicitude the well-being of her people. By prescribed law, by authorized publicity, by informed public opinion, let her continue to strive to provide that all conditions under which her citizens live are worthy of the highest state of man. Healthful housing, wholesome food, sanitary working conditions, reasonable hours, a fair wage for a fair day's work, opportunity full and free, justice, speedy and impartial and at a cost within the reach of all, are among the objects not only to be sought, but made absolutely certain and secure. Government is not, must not be, a cold, impersonal machine, but a human and more human agency, appealing to the reason, satisfying the heart, full of mercy, assisting the good, resisting the wrong, delivering the weak from any impositions of the powerful. This is not paternalism. It is not a servitude imposed from without, but the freedom of a righteous self-direction from within."
Silent Cal is something of a misnomer. As we kind of heard there, he's got some pretty deep thoughts. He's not shy about expressing them. Coolidge talked a lot, especially to the press. The Calvin Coolidge Memorial Foundation writes, quote, "Of all the 17 presidents who have held press conferences, from President Wilson to President Obama, President Calvin Coolidge held more of them for the amount of time he was in office than any of his predecessors or successors. His 521 sessions in 5.5 years were surpassed only by President Franklin Roosevelt, who had twice the number of sessions.
Re-elected to his own term, Coolidge was incredibly popular, leading a nation that was prosperous and at peace. Actually, people couldn't even get their brains around it when he declared, quote, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928, end quote, but he didn't think it was good for democracy that he should run again. And that choice was eventually taken away after Roosevelt. TR didn't run again. Coolidge didn't run again. And I'm sure there are a handful of others who chose not to. Well, LBJ chose not to run again, right?
Well, prior to even Lincoln, they're sort of after Jackson because the Whigs had popped up in resistance to this kind of King Andrew imperial presidency. They all sort of were doing one and done, which is the constitutional term limit, actually, in the state of Virginia, just 6 years. And that was also the Confederate States of America. That was their term, was 6 years. And then you would just go home. And so they didn't really want to run again. He didn't feel that it was good. He'd already served. And he also didn't feel begrudge anybody if in some great national emergency they maybe needed to run again. Those were actually very similar to TR's words. He said, somewhere down the road, there might be a calamity or a world war. And he didn't know what was coming, but it was amazing considering it was his own cousin,
right,
that he said, you know, you might want to stay on more than once. But he unfortunately decided not to run again. And he was still such a young man. And it's a guarantee he would have been elected in 1920 to another term as president. Mm-hmm. But it just didn't work out. No. And Grover Cleveland, too, who we didn't hear, was also, they kept thinking he was going to run. TR even feared that he might run against him in 1904. People were really, they could come back and run then in a way that I don't think they can today, or people really think about them running.
Well, there's not much left of people after the way today's campaigns go. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Back home in retirement, Calvin Coolidge wrote of his career from lawyer to governor to the White House. There's only one form of political strategy in which I have any confidence, and that is try to do the right thing. Which I think is pretty immortal words. That's the kind of stuff we love here at Angry History. And the 1928 Republican nomination went, instead of Coolidge, to Coolidge's Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, who was a brilliant man. He'd been all over the world, very fascinating character. And he'd also run the relief effort to save millions in Europe after the Great War's devastation. He was a well-known figure, a popular figure. People thought he could handle anything.
Yeah, but something came that no one had to handle quite to the degree. And that was the stock market crash. Just 6 months into his term, he was just overmatched. This was beyond his control. And his efforts to bring the same relief to Americans as he had to Europeans, it just fell flat. And by, 32, nobody wanted to be the Republican nominee, not even him. Somebody had to run. So the GOP nominated Hoover at their convention in Chicago.
He really actually pushed for FDR, talked to friendly reporters and such, and he thought he would be easier to defeat and easier to run against, which is, it just shows you. Nobody knows who's in their midst when they're looking right at him in the face, right? Hoover really shows how sometimes these great resumes, John Quincy Adams, Herbert Hoover, James Buchanan, Martin Van Buren, Taft, Nixon. These guys have great, fantastic resumes, and they just don't pan out as presidents. They don't get reelected. I mean, George H.W. Bush, that was his big thing, that he had the big resume. That's why Reagan picked him as VP. And so, you know, that doesn't always work out. Sometimes it's the guys who just sort of pop in there,
sure,
that end up rising to the occasion of greatness. So here's our final clip. It's from Herbert Hoover's acceptance speech at that bitter 1932 convention, here at the dawn of the Great Depression, when so many terrible things are going on. And you can really hear he's a broken man at this point, shattered by the severity of the Great Depression and suffering of fellow Americans.
If it shall appear that while I have had the honor of the presidency, that I have contributed to the part required from this high office to bring the Republic through this dark night, and if in my administration we shall see the break of dawn of the better day, I shall have done my part in the world. No man can have a greater honor than that. And I have but one desire, and that is to see my country again on the road to prosperity, which shall be more sane and lasting through the lessons of this experience, to see the principles and ideals of the American people perpetuated.
Oh, yeah, he does sound grim. I mean, there had every reason to. Well, folks, listen, that does it for our look back at early presidential voices. And one of the things we like to do here at The Old Angry History is to try to bring the black and white photos in our books to life as best we can.
Yeah, and today I feel like we've not only done that, but we've made them speak to us from a century ago out of wax tubes, out of these, you know, very, very primitive recording sessions. So we'd like to thank Benjamin Harrison and all of our other presidents for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed it, folks. Thanks so much for listening, for downloading, for telling a friend.
Yep. Hey, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And we will speak to you soon. Who knows? I'm bound for New York in a couple of days for the legendary Mojo's 40th birthday. And that means Dean and I will be in the same city with some recording devices. Who knows what could happen?
Anything can happen.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
We are the mediocre presidents. You won't find our faces on dollars or on cents. There's Taylor and there's Tyler. There's Gilmore and there's Hayes. There's William Henry Harrison.
I died in 30 days.
We are the adequate, forgettable, occasionally regrettable.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.